Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:35 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is April 3rd, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with the long-term chart of the Dow Gold Ratio, because it has been one of the most reliable indicators for secular bull markets that we have. It has more than 100 years of history, and in each of the major secular bull markets we've seen over the period of that time, then there have been some very clear consistency characteristics. The first is that there is approximately 35 years on average between the peaks. Each of the peaks is above the last. And during the secular bull market periods, then it does tend to find support in the region of a long-term moving average. And none of that is now true. That's a really quite significant, deviation from the long-term cycle. So we have to at least pay some due consideration to that, that something has definitely changed. So let's zoom in a little. When we look at the fact that the Dow Gold Ratio bottomed in 2011, that was not so difficult to understand. The gold price peaked and the stock market started to take off and break out to new high ground, particularly on the S&P 500 around 2012. So it would have been logical to assume that that was the bottom and that we were likely now in a new secular bull market. We're 8 years in, and now, rather than having a mean reversion event, which is quite normal in the context of a secular bull market, we've had a very significant pullback. So that is, I think, really quite an important point, that we have a major questioning of the secular bull market hypothesis for stocks over commodities. Now, that's, I think, one of the important characteristics, which I think it's worth considering. Why do we look at the Dow Gold Ratio? Because it's been something that's been particularly relevant for 100 years. But the question that this deterioration in the consistency raises is whether the relationship has broken down, or are the constituents of the ratio now pointing towards different characteristics of the global economy? Because 100 years ago, the Dow Jones was mostly constituted by industrials, and that's no longer the case. It now has insurance companies, banks, technology companies, consumer discretionary companies, and the odd industrial. So it is difficult to say that it's still an industrial index. 100 years ago, gold was money, and now it is still a safe haven asset. It is still a measure of value. It's a barometer against which the worst proclivities of governments to devalue their currencies it can be measured. But it is not money in the same way, perhaps the better way to say it is still a very good definition of what money represents, but it is no longer deemed currency. So we've had a very different definition emerge of both constituents of the ratio. And now the question is whether that really matters. Does that matter to the constitution of the ratio? Or has it completely lost its efficacy? And that's an enormously important question, because I never thought that we'd see this breakdown. It never occurred to me to really question the makeup or the validity of the ratio. And now that's an important, point that we need to consider. One thing that is important is oil. And we can look at the Dow Oil Ratio. Now, when we look at that, it is important to make sure that we're looking at the right kind of oil contract. So here we have Well, for one thing, we have more history, so we have an extra 20 years of history. The next point is that it has not broken down. The next is that it bottomed in 2008. The peaks, if there's a significant peak in 1905, there was another peak around 1929, so about 24 years. The next peak was in 1965, so that's about 36 years. The next peak again was in 1998, so about 27 years. And now we're still trending higher. So that is an additional way of thinking about it. At the beginning of the 20th century, oil was a novelty. And then we had the birth of the automobile, global transportation that carried through into jet transportation, the massive explosion in ocean transportation, then, of course, the plastics revolution. So it's perhaps not so such a wild leap in terms of the analytical side to think that perhaps the Dow oil ratio is a better measure right now, that it probably gives a better underpinning to the way of looking at the market from a secular bull market environment or not, because oil is more like a currency, or at least it is the basis on which economic activity is based. And it is logical that companies have to pay for energy. So when energy prices are high, then it is going to have a deleterious effect on their profitability, and oil will probably outperform the companies. And when companies, well, when oil prices are low, then that's a benefit to companies. And that seems to make a great deal of sense. That's particularly relevant for the economy probably right now. But we've also seen that the global economy has moved on again, and we're in a much more data-centric environment today. So therefore, the big question is whether that argument is reaching for straws. Is it something that makes sense right now? Or should we be looking for some other kind of measure? The problem with looking for an additional measure is that we have to go and iterate again. Because today, and perhaps the most, I think, efficacious way of looking at it would be to think that it is data is now going to be the clear beneficiary, that it is data is going to be going to represent the underpinnings of the global economy. But why should that move in an inverse correlation with the stock market? So that's something that is really quite different. That is something that we do need to pay additional consideration to, that oil and gold share the characteristic that one is valued for its rarity and for its permanence. The other is valued for its energy potential. But data is valued both for its influence on the global economy and also for its economies of scale. That the kinds of lessons that can be learned through automation can be infinitely applied. And that's not something that is extractive, or it's not an extractive process in quite the same way that commodities are. There is obviously the argument that you have data mining, that it is the massive accommodation of semiconductors and the global technology sector that have created this huge wave of data, which is only likely to accelerate in the next decades. We are in the process now of being or having 5G networks made available to us. The rather simplistic way that people are explaining it is that it takes seconds to download a 3-hour movie rather than minutes. So that's one way of thinking about it. But the most important thing about 5G is that it is going to eliminate lag. It's also going to put supercomputers in our pockets. So the range of what's possible, the kinds of services that can be provided, the kinds of questions that can be answered, much, I think perhaps even more important, the kinds of questions that can be asked, that these are the kinds of evolutions in the provision of services that are going to arise as a result of technology. Well, that has nothing to do with the coronavirus. In fact, it's perhaps going to represent one of the range of potential solutions to the problem, because we're seeing now that quantum computers are being devoted to analyzing potential solutions. Supercomputers are also coming into play. The number of potential and active solutions and treatment methods that have arisen as a result of this crisis is ballooning by the day. On the one hand, we're seeing that there is a wave of new infections circling the earth. So, and it is, and I think this map was a good one, and I haven't seen a global map yet, but it's looking at when the peak infection rate is going to spread across the USA. It's very much going from east to west. But the big point here, of course, is that this is a very similar condition to what we have in the rest of the world. It started in China, and it then popped up in Italy. Italy has had their peak. Now it's moving into France and Spain. Spain has quite likely had their peak. France and the UK and Germany haven't quite had theirs yet. New York may now be peaking or very close to peaking. It'll probably be another month before California peaks. So we're getting a rolling wave of infections and then responses and peak infections going right around the world. It's then likely that the peak infection rate in a number of the emerging markets is also going to arrive later than many of the cities in the USA. Well, that pretty much ensures that we're going to be dealing with the coronavirus well into May. We may see the peak in the infection rate in May globally, but then it's going to be a question of how long does it take us to recover. But I think the most important thing to bear in mind is that we may recover in 2 months, 3 months, or 6 months, but it's very likely we are going to recover. The massive quantity of additional money that is being pumped into the market is something that is going to have permanent effects. The unlimited source of additional quantitative easing from the Federal Reserve. And I'm posting an article in here today which is highlighting the fiscal responses of the G7 nations, which, if you start adding it all together, is approaching about $2 trillion just on the fiscal front. Then there is the likelihood of massive infrastructure development. On the one hand, it is the ideal time to borrow a ton of money when interest rates are zero and there is a clear need to employ people. On the other, there is a great deal of infrastructure that needs to be replaced. The last very significant infrastructure building was back in the 1950s, immediately after the Second World War, for much of Europe and North America. And a lot of the infrastructure that was built was never designed to tackle the traffic that they are currently dealing with, whether that is in terms of load over bridges, the demands that are being put on dams, or the highway system generally. That suggests that we're going to see significant infrastructure development, and that is likely to be stimulative. And of course, we have the fact that energy prices are really very low right now. And while that does represent an existential threat for a significant number of businesses, then it also withdraws a significant headwind to growth for a number of consumers, whether that is regular consumers, companies, or nations. It is certainly something that is going to ameliorate their financial situation. But the big picture here is, if we start to look out a year or two from now, then the likelihood is we will be in a recovery type of scenario, and that we're going to see a lot of valuations will have improved substantially in the short term, and then they'll probably inflate again over the medium term, for the simple reason that this massive accommodation that we're seeing is multiples the size of anything we've seen before. When we look at the velocity of money, this, I think, is an underappreciated measure. And it's at record lows. But the last time it was updated was at the end of last year. So it has been trending downwards since the late 1990s. It is no coincidence that the peak in the velocity of money coincided with the birth of the internet and, or I guess, the prevalence of the growth of the internet and online shopping. If you remember, all the way back in the late 1990s, the buzzword for the internet was disintermediation. And that process of disintermediation is still accelerating. So with the economic crisis as a result of the coronavirus, then velocity of money is going to collapse. And it could very well be zero, or extremely close to zero, by the time we see it turning around again. Now, the most important thing to bear in mind is that the lower the velocity of money, the more money is required to be printed in order for the economic potential of the economy to remain flat. And they have to print even more money to start to kick up the velocity of money again. So we're not going to have an inflationary outcome until we start to see the velocity of money turning around. But the pace of technological innovation, and it's not just about disintermediation any longer. It's in fact about dematerialization is the buzzword of the internet and technology in here today. What I mean by dematerialization is that we used to have bookshops, and now we have a Kindle. We used to have record shops, and now we have Spotify, or we have Google Music, or we used to have TVs, now we have phones. And of course, the phone, the book, and the music, the bank, and the recording studio, the camera, the video camera, occasionally I've had to do promotional videos, and I can simply download an app which is a teleprompter, and I simply just talk into the phone and read the script. These are the kinds of things that pop up from time to time, but the reality is that when that is all an example of dematerialization. Now, when we start to think about, well, what's going to dematerialize next, the ultimate, I think, process of technological innovation is in the actual piece of technology itself disappearing. And we increasingly move towards a virtual world. Well, on the one hand, we know now which of us are going to be effective working from home. Some people tend to be considerably more productive when they work from home, others less so. That does suggest that we're going to have a lot more people that choose to work from home and are even more effective. They then become more valuable employees. Of course, there are others that are much more effective when they're surrounded by other people and a rigorous schedule, and those people will still end up working in the office. But I think it is probably going to turn out to be more of a choice than a stricture. And that pretty much means that we can dematerialize the office. There doesn't have to be nearly as much commercial space if more people are willing to work from home. So that's one potential outcome from the coronavirus. Commercial real estate is already under a great deal of stress. And one thing that we've definitely seen over the course of the last decade is that it is non-bank lenders have been the biggest beneficiaries. When we look at, for example, LendingTree, where back in 2010, it was trading at $8, and it peaked in 2019 over $400. That's, I think, representative of the incredible move that we had in terms of the dominance of non-bank lenders in the mortgage sector in particular. Well, they are now under the most duress because the conventional banks have not been engaged in mortgage lending. That's part of the reason why it's been said that they're better capitalized, because they have had successive avenues for profit simply cut off to the conventional banking sector. The non-bank lenders, there's a significant number of them, are probably going to go bust as a result of the kind of environment we have right now. And additionally, then, we have the mortgage REITs, which are leveraged by nature, and they are also rapidly going bust. So how well is the commercial real estate sector going to recover from this environment? If more people are willing to work from home, that's probably bullish for home building. Certainly, the one thing that my family have discussed on repeated occasions is that, owing to my business and my wife's business, what we would much prefer to have is a 5-bedroom house where we would have an office and a recording studio. I would certainly much prefer to do videos with myself standing in front of a screen than I would simply talking over the charts as I'm doing today. I would also like to be able to do virtual chart seminars, and I think that that may be a potential avenue in here this year because of the prohibitions on traveling. Certainly want to continue doing the chart seminar because we've been doing it for 50 years, and I'd like to make this 51 consecutive years. Now let's continue to think about dematerialization. Certainly I've seen that the Oculus Quest is a revolutionary product that Facebook has come up with. It means absolutely nothing to their bottom line. They make 99% of their revenue from advertising. They've just decided to hire an additional 10,000 people. Facebook is past its major growth phase. They are now trying to police their networks. That's an effort to try and self-regulate. But when we think about the role of virtual reality, it's really quite incredible that you can go into the or you can put on a headset, you can select the cinema option, you can go and watch a James Bond movie for free so that you can try it out. Other people just pop up next to you. And there have been occasions, I've tried it out a couple of times, that they try to initiate conversation because it has a live mic while you're watching the commercials during the movie. Well, it is so seamless and so easy to do. And the reality of the situation is so convincing that I really can see a potential time in future where we are simply going to dispense with physical meetings. It will be so much easier to simply pop on a headset and have that very personal relationship in a virtual world that is just very difficult to replicate in a conference call or in a video call. The rise and fall of Zoom Media has been one of the things that has made headlines in here this week, because they've had difficulties with security. And online security is going to continue to be a very significant factor. One thing that has inhibited the growth of the cybersecurity sector has been the unwillingness of companies to, in fact, pay for it. And they would much prefer to pay to compensate their data, or the compensate the users of their networks for the loss of their data, than they would to try and protect it in the future or in the first place. But the massive quantity of data that's going to become available, which is multiples of what we have already today as a result of 5G, is going to raise really quite significant cybersecurity issues. We also have the potential that quantum computing, which is increasing at a double exponential pace, is something that is going to put a great deal of pressure on all cybersecurity products. So this is going to be a rapidly evolving sector overall. If I go back now and start to think again about what are the kinds of ratios that we might look to for the economy in future, well, the reason that we looked at the Dow Gold ratio all the way back 100 years ago and going forward, because it was, one was the dominance of stocks versus commodities, or the dominance of stocks relative to the purchasing power of conventional money. The Dow oil ratio was about the economic basis in energy and the inverse correlation that the that consumers have relative to the price of oil. Well, if we're going and to think about what it is that will give us a measure of the strength of the future economy, it's got to be something like the availability of data, or the strength of the network on the one hand, and how well that data is being used on the other. So we simply at present do not have the tools to really put into action that kind of comparison. The only kind of strength of network measure we have is Bitcoin, and I just simply don't believe that Bitcoin is going to be the ultimate solution. But it is certainly bouncing from the 5,000 area, and it got down to 4,000 and rallied back 50% in a really quite dynamic manner. Now, Bitcoin was the first iteration. The way that I tend to think about Bitcoin is very much like the early internet. And I think that Bitcoin is to the future of data management in much the same way that Netscape was, or has a relation to Instagram and Facebook. I think it is probably a first use case. We're simply not there yet in terms of the utility that it can be put to. But the reality is that with the massive quantity of money that is being printed and the acceleration in the total assets of central banks, then it is likely that eventually we're going to get to a point where interest rates do become a really quite significant issue for the global economy. The total assets of central banks, having been below 20 trillion until about 6 weeks ago, are now up to almost 22 trillion, and this is still a trending market. Nothing is likely to arrest the continued printing of money on a global basis until we get to the zero bound on interest rates globally. One of the reasons why Japan has been able to manage its very low interest rate environment for a prolonged period is because they've been investing heavily elsewhere for very high for higher yields, particularly relative to the domestic environment. Well, when we look at the interest rate environment in Japan and Europe, then we still have extremely low interest rates, but we have also seen that the interest rates that we've had available in the USA or in the UK or Australia and Canada have not gone negative. And then, of course, we have high interest rates in many emerging markets. Well, that suggests that in a globalized economy, then there is scope for continued monetary accommodation. And that monetary accommodation is going to continue to be possible as long as the velocity of money continues lower. So on the one hand, we have the massive explosion of money printing. And on the other, we have the massive explosion in data and data utility. So at some stage, it is the basis for economic activity is going to become the access to data. And that is going to represent a massive reordering of the global economy, because certainly we saw in here this week that the evolution of the shale gas market all the way back in 2006 has now had the massive game-changing effect on the market, which has been incredibly pronounced. We, David and I, predicted nearly a decade ago, certainly from about 2012 onwards, that the USA was going to become energy independent. We had a great deal of pushback on that prognostication at the time, but the USA became energy independent last year. Now, quite whether it is still energy independent with prices having collapsed since the beginning of this year is an open question. But the one thing that we do know is that oil prices had an upside weekly key reversal in here this week. So that's a low of at least near-term significance. But it is a fantastic piece of evidence to support the view that we've had a massive change in the status quo. Because if anyone had predicted that OPEC would be irrelevant by the time we get around to 2020, then no one would have believed them. But the reality is today that the vast majority of OPEC producers can produce at a sustaining cost of somewhere below $20. But their national budgets can't support that price. So they are heavily dependent on higher prices to balance their domestic budgets. At the same time, the quantity of oil that's being produced outside of OPEC and the non-OPEC production growth rate has far outpaced the OPEC growth rate in terms of production. So they're less influential in terms of the global oil market. And then the developed economies of the world are simply consuming less oil. That means that the oil market is now much more heavily dependent on oil demand growth coming through from the emerging markets. But it is extremely likely that China has already hit peak car. So not only are we seeing that the biggest emerging market is already trying to damp down on demand for new petrol vehicles, but that there's a global push to try and transition away from oil as a transportation fuel. And again, that is something that is going to inhibit the ability of oil to represent a foundation for global economic growth. So we are rapidly transitioning into a much more important phase. in many respects, the industrials were by far the most important companies in the first half of the 20th century. In the second half of the 20th century, it was the energy companies were by far the most important in terms of global economic growth. But in the first half of the 21st century, it's likely to be the data companies are going to represent the foundation of the global economy. That also means that they are more likely to face interference from government, because governments already fear the influence that data is having on their ability to govern, on the stability of the status quo within the governing bodies of various countries, and also the ability of data to sway elections. Well, that is also a testimony to just how powerful data is. Then, of course, there is the clear conclusion that a number of the data providers have been able to prosper because they have been able to commercialize the fact that free will is a myth, that people can be conditioned to respond, or that products can be created to respond to the conditioning effect of advertising and clickbait. So that is one of the reasons why advertising via Facebook and Google tends to work. And that also is the reason why targeted ads work, because they've been able to identify through people's actions and their social networks what kind of personality type they have developed, and therefore what kind of marketing will work best on them. Now, if we are being we're having our personal proclivities marketed to, then quite whether we have free will in terms of the purchasing decision is very much open to question. Now, that's very much the dark side of data. It is something that has been enormously profitable for companies like Google and Facebook. It's also one of the reasons why the Chinese government has been so clear in their control of their domestic data market. When, for example, we look at Meituan Dianping, then that company intertwines communist propaganda into your choice of restaurant. So the power of data is not simply in dematerialization of physical goods, it's also in terms of the dematerialization of propaganda. And that is a significant factor that every consumer should be aware of. It's something that we can be aware of and do something about in free societies. It's something that consumers are incapable of doing anything about in unfree societies. When we think about then the short, medium, and long term, the S&P 500 has pulled back in an incredibly dramatic fashion, and it is now below the 1,000-day moving average. Oops, sorry, the wrong chart. The 1,000-day moving average has been an area of support during secular bull markets in the past, and it is now below the 1,000-day moving average. So we have to conclude that this is a significant top formation, that we've had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and that we have had an upside key reversal last week, or it was an upside key reversal on the NASDAQ. It was an outside week on the S&P 500. The minimum to confirm that we're back, or that this is more than a short-term low, would be a sustained move back above the trend, the 1,000-day moving average. We could subsequently see a period of ranging and confirmation that we are back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment will be a sustained move back above the 200-day moving average. At the present moment, That is looks like a big ask. With the price right now at 26.45 for the 1,000-day moving average, it closed at 24.88. It could rally 600 points or 25% to simply close the overextension relative to the 200-day moving average. And therefore, it is likely that we're going to see a period of ranging. And that's usually the base case. After a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, people ask these types of questions. On the one hand, people say, golly, this has been an awfully big pullback. It must be a buying opportunity. I've been waiting for a buying opportunity like this for years. Finally, I get one, so I'm buying. There are going to be the people that got stopped out, the ones that sold out on the way down. They're going to be in cash, and they're going to say, well, golly, I don't want to miss out on a buying opportunity. I got out at the top, so I'm going to buy back right now. And we have a lot of that. We have a lot of people who buy the dips. And buying the dips is the most reliable strategy in a secular bull market. And it will work all the way through until the top. And then it will fail. But the conditioning effect is that people have been buying the dip all the way through this this bull market over the last decade. The one thing, if I had to say that I'm worried about, is that most of the investors I've met have been overly anxious to buy. That usually when we get to a market low, you have to shout from the rooftops that it is time to buy, that people need a lot of convincing because they have experienced losses. Now, certainly there are a lot of people sitting on big losses in here right now because we've got a number of shares that are down 50%. But when we think about the actions of the retail investor, then the kinds of companies that they have been having bigger positions in and been most active in buying have been the bigger weightings in the NASDAQ. And the NASDAQ has just about unwound all of the advance put in 2019. And even then, it's only the second half of 2019. And it has rebounded and recouped most of the decline from the last couple of weeks. It has not been able to push back above the 200-day moving average, but it did bounce from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And in a secular bull market, the 1,000-day moving average does represent an area of support, and the NASDAQ has been the clear leader. Now, it is worth highlighting that the NASDAQ 100 is a very large cap index, and it is stocked by significant investment grade companies. So it's investment grade bonds that the Federal Reserve is buying as part of its bond buying program. When we look at then the fact that the S&P 500 has got a lot more companies, and by the time you get down to the end of the rota for the S&P 500, then there are a lot of companies that are just about hanging on to investment grade if they're not already in junk status. When we look at the mid-caps, then that index has pulled back by considerably more than the S&P 500. It is a very long way from the 1,000-day moving average. And when we look at small caps, then we have a very similar condition. So on the one hand, we can consider that the large caps are going to continue to be those that receive the greatest assistance from government. They're also the companies that are the leaders in terms of not only data collection, but also data innovation and processing power and interpretation. So those are likely to continue to be the focus of any kind of recovery. And when we think about what is likely in terms of the creation of value and the evolution of the technological frontier over the course of the next decade, it's likely to be very much concentrated in data. We also have to think about the fact that all of this is happening in a global economy. There is obviously now a great deal of pressure coming to bear on consumers. We know that there are going to be a significant number of delinquencies in terms of the auto sector. One thing that's important is that these data series are not updated all that often. And auto loan delinquencies have been rising for 5 years already, but they haven't been updated since the end of December. Well, if the delinquency rate was at 5% at the end of 2019, it's probably going to be more like 20% by the time it's next updated. And perhaps not even next update, but the update after that, considering that it is reported with at least a one quarter lag. So there are definitely going to be cheap cars. But of course, when we look at, for example, credit card delinquencies, again, this is not a sector that tends to be updated on a daily basis. But when we look at 90-day delinquencies, then that had been going the opposite direction. It had just been doing nothing at all for most of the last 5 years. So people were failing to make payments on their vehicles, but they were keeping up with their credit cards. Now, one of the points that I think is particularly relevant is the savings rate. There is a great deal of discussion, and it's one of the factors that is most often quoted about the health of the consumer, is that the savings rate has improved considerably over the course of the last decade. There's a lot less talk about what goes into the savings rate. On the one hand, savings can be what people have in the bank and their personal reserves. Now, when we look at the data about personal reserves and the ability of savers to meet a $300 or $400 emergency, the most common statistic is that half of people would not be able to make that kind of payment. So how can the savings rate be so high if half the population can't meet those kinds of obligations? Well, it's because, on the one hand, Social Security contributions are imputed as being part of the savings rate, but the vast majority of people consider those to be taxes, not savings, because you can't access them. Then the other things that move into the savings rate tend to be the value of one's home and the value of stock portfolios. Well, if delinquencies are going to start rising, and it is absolutely inevitable that they are going to start rising, then the chances are that we're going to see the savings rate deteriorate regardless of whether people have money in the bank or not. You can also see that this hasn't been updated since 2016. And I will try and find a mortgage delinquency chart for next Monday. Now, when we can see, therefore, that the consumer was under pressure on one front, at least auto loans, before the coronavirus crisis. And the vast majority of people have been living paycheck to paycheck for a prolonged period, so they're under a great deal of stress. When we then think about how this is all playing out in other markets, I think it's important to highlight that the NASDAQ is among the markets that has pulled back least. When we look at the FTSE 100, it has pulled back in a violent manner, and it shares a lot more commonality with the mid-cap and small-cap sectors in the US than it does with anything else. When we look at the DAX index, it's a really quite similar condition. The Nikkei in Japan had been ranging above 20,000 for a prolonged period, and now it is so far still trading below that level. I think at the minimum we're going to see some ranging evolve. The big question about what we can expect next is, where is that range going to form? Is the range going to form below the 1,000-day moving average or above it? That's by far the most important question from the perspective of the longer-term investor. One thing we know for certain is that investment-grade sectors are going to be supported by the government. There is the potential that if high yield continues to experience selling pressure, then we're also likely to see support coming through for the high yield sector. I think that would be one of the biggest signals that we are at the bottom of the market. If central banks are willing to do to stoop to those levels to support asset prices, then it will be difficult for bears to maintain their short positions. Eventually, that is likely to represent a problem in terms of the bond markets. And there are obviously significant reasons for why gold should continue to rally. When we think about what is happening in terms of the reduction in the purchasing power of fiat currencies, then gold is likely to continue to represent a hedge against the clear intention of governments to devalue their way out of these problems. The deficits that are going to be accumulated as a result of the response to the coronavirus are almost so epic in scale to be beyond comparison outside of world wars. But we need to see the economic bounce back, and we're not there yet. And my best guess is that it'll probably be into the second half of the year before we really get economic activity starting to pop back up again. The one thing that I have not seen discussed at length with regard to the coronavirus is the reason that we're all locked down is to try and take pressure off of the healthcare system. However, if we get to a point where the healthcare system is sufficiently well provisioned and has the resources made available to it in order to deal with spikes in infection rates and hospitalizations, then once we get to that point, there is no logical reason to persist with full lockdowns, and children can start going back to school and economic activity can start to pick back up. The one thing we've definitely seen is that rapid testing is now being developed, and it is only a question of time before it is mass produced. Once we have rapid testing, then it is going to be much easier to identify people that have got antibodies already. Those are the people that will be most useful in treating the infected, and we're likely to have a vaccine in the market sometime towards the end of this year. So I do think that this is an enormously disruptive event. There are certainly going to be dire consequences for small businesses and for individual consumers, but it is not a situation that is going to last indefinitely. And I think it is unlikely that we're going to get a second wave. And the reason we will not get a second wave is because of the technological advances that have evolved in the last 100 years. The simple fact of the matter is that if we cannot compare the current economic environment to what we had 100 years ago, I think it is at least reasonable to conclude that we can't compare the healthcare system today to what we had 100 years ago. It is therefore, I think, my base case that we're likely to see the market evolve from a very dire bear market environment in the current period, where there is the potential that we will yet see new lows posted. I personally think that the lows will evolve when the buy the dip strategy feels wrong rather than opportune. I think the vast majority of people today feel like it is an opportune moment to try and buy the dip, but usually that is not how bottoms form. It's simply that we've all been conditioned to think that buying the dip is by far the best thing to do. What that suggests is that biding one's time is certainly likely to be beneficial. But at the same time, we've had some of the dividend-paying stocks that have come back in an extraordinarily violent manner and are bouncing. When we look at some of the dividend aristocrats, there is absolutely no doubt that they pulled back more violently than the wider market, but they have also bounced better. And some of these companies have never cut their dividends. I have posted lists of investment trusts in the UK this week, which have never cut their dividends. And I think those are also among the trusts that have popped back up in the most dynamic fashion. But I don't think we're going to see them back at all-time highs immediately. I think that is just too much to ask for. There are too many challenges in the short term. There are going to be businesses that do not open after this crisis ends. And that is likely to have an effect on the economy and on consumer sentiment. So there is obviously going to be some form of rebound once we do see a lessening of these lockdowns, but we might still be in lockdowns well into May, and in that time sentiment is probably going to deteriorate significantly. It's usually by the time we've had major declines and sentiment has deteriorated that we get buying opportunities. We've had the counter trend rally that has put in a short term low. Now we're likely to see the range, and once the range has formed, how long it has gone on for, how much of the overextension relative to trend means have been unwound, and how well lows hold, that will all inform the determination of whether a bottom is more than a short term, but a potentially a medium term low has formed. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.